You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, presented by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool.
Yeah, it's been a huge year for me, you know, winning E3 and such a great tour, getting married, honeymoon, book coming out and everything. But I think the highlight has to be winning a podcast Pedaleur des Champs award, for sure, that t-shirt. It's pride of place in my wardrobe.
This is only the beginning. You can't even imagine what we are going to do for the future.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
Crazy gang back together. First time in 2016. How are you, chaps?
Very well, thank you. Yeah. Yeah. Rested, recovered, ready to go.
Well, you've been cycling, haven't you, Lionel?
You've been cycling, Richard.
It's like, obvious.
It is, yeah. Looking ripped. Looking good.
Well, I mean, we've been following our Trainer Roads programme. We'll talk maybe a bit more about that. But I was out in Mallorca a couple of weeks ago. That was our first podcast of 2016 from the training camps. It was very noticeable because we did a ride last year at the Team Sky training camp. They organised a media race and I was an embarrassment to myself. And all of us, actually, I let us down last year at the Team Sky media race. This year, I think I give a very good account of myself, even to say so myself.
2016, the Chinese year of the peacock, of the self-indulgent peacock.
No, I was. It was a very noticeable difference, a great sort of advert for the Trainer Road programme. As Coach Chad keeps telling us, it's just a case of sticking with it, just doing it consistently. And, you know, you don't see a sudden improvement. It's just gradual realisation that you're a little bit fitter.
I can feel Daniel zoning out already.
He's just jealous.
I mean, you know, he feels left out of this whole Trainer Road thing. But my experience is exactly the same. I was in France cycling for a few days and felt better than I've felt for a long, long time. And I really struggled with the last block of Trainer Road. I was quitting sessions two-thirds of the way through, didn't feel like I was performing very well, but the proof of the pudding is in the eating.
You need a vision of Lance Armstrong, like in the Kieran Hodgson show that we saw last year, where Lance Armstrong appears at your shoulder and does a version of his dodgeball cameo about quitting. Anyway, where are we, Lionel?
We're in a studio at the headquarters of Audio Boom near Tower Bridge in London today.
Daniel, how are you, Daniel? We missed you at the end of last year. You were on sabbatical in Berlin.
Back. Yeah, refreshed. Yeah, you know me.
We do. And a few weeks ago, you were back in Berlin at the Giant Alpecin team launch.
That's correct.
How was that?
It was very good. It was in the Italian embassy, slightly odd venue. There was a tenuous link with Tom Dumoulin's Giro ambitions. He announced there that he's going to ride the Giro d'Italia. He's going to be targeting that this year. Otherwise, yeah, there were Ferrero Rocher passed around.
Really?
So, no, actually there weren't. But it really felt like that kind of occasion. It felt like that kind of
the ambassador's context. Reception.
Yeah, it really was. very lax security as well, I noticed.
How else would you get in?
Well, exactly. You know, about 100 journalists piled into this embassy. I think there'd been terrorist threats in Berlin the day before. I was expecting to be patted down, strip searched, but
expecting
everything, Daniel.
None of that took place, so in we went, and it was a very cordial time was had by all.
Well, we'll be hearing from some interviews from that team launch a bit later on, but of course, Giant Alpecin been in the news for more unfortunate reasons. We'll talk about the racing season has kicked off, we should point out. And in fact, you're going to give us a roundup, but we're going to talk about the awful crash involving Giant Alpecin in a moment because I happen to be in the same hotel as them at the weekend in Spain. But first of all, we are going to talk about the racing in the next part. So Lionel, will you give us a sort of roundup, please?
2016 road season kicked off with the Tour Down Under, the first World Tour race of the year in Adelaide, as it always is. After last season, which was ruined by crashes and broken bones, Simon Gerrans won the Tour Down Under for the fourth time in his career. He won back-to-back stages to set himself up and then defended his lead on the Adelaide Alpe d'Huez, Willunga Hill, where Richie Port got his first victory in BMC colours after his move from Sky, which almost certainly means he's going to win the Tour de France. just put it out there now, might as well. Caleb Ewan, the 21-year-old Orica Green Edge sprinter, took the curtain-raising Tour Down Under Classic and two stages of the Tour Down Under itself, and he attracted attention on social media, particularly with his Cav-esque low-profile sprinting style with his nose almost on the handlebars. Quite remarkable.
Licking the road.
Richard, you pointed out the pictures of those of that on Twitter. Meanwhile, over in Argentina, Nairo Quintana finished third in the Tour de San Luis, won by his younger brother and Movistar teammate Daya Quintana. Another of the young sprinters tipped to challenge the likes of Cavendish Kittel & Co, Fernando Gaviria of Etics Quickstep, won a stage but then crushed out, sustaining a fractured arm. Adriano Malori, the Movistar Italian time trialist, he suffered a serious crash in Argentina as well and was put into a medically induced coma in hospital. The latest reports, though, are that he is recovering well. And in fact, crashes really have dominated the first week or so of the season, because in Calpe, in southern Spain, a car collided with a group of giant Alpecin riders while they were out training. John Degenkolb and Warren Barguil were among those involved. And as you say, Richard, you were out there in Spain. We know that a 73-year-old British woman has been charged with, we believe, or has been reported, driving on the wrong side of the road and collided with the group of giant Alpecin riders. Richard, you were out there in Spain. What more can you tell us?
Well, yeah, I was in Calpe and I was there to interview John Degenkolb and Tom Dumoulin, among other people. Obviously, those interviews didn't happen. Dumoulin wasn't involved in the crash, but the whole team were in shock, really, and very upset, and certainly not in the mood to do interviews. I just arrived, really, on Saturday when, you know, word filtered around the hotel that this awful crash had happened. There were six giant Alpecin riders riding together in a group. Warren Barguil was there, Chad Haga, the American rider who was worst off, John Degenkolb. So it was quite a group of riders. I got a lift the following morning with Ramon Sinkeldum, the rider, big sort of classics rider, who was also in the group, and his face was a mess, covered in bandages. He actually had a broken clavicle that he didn't realise at the time, and that was only discovered when he returned home. So, yeah, there was it was terrible, and it was one of those moments where, you know, I sort of felt very uncomfortable being there as a journalist, because, frankly, you felt like you were intruding on private grief a little bit. The giant Alpecin riders, there was a big group of them there, 12 to 15 riders, sat together in the evening and chatted. And, I mean, it's worth pointing out that at that point, I don't think the full extent of the injuries were known. There was still a lot of concern about Haga in particular, and whether he'd sustained any brain injury. That is not the case, thankfully. And he's been very amusing the last couple of days on Twitter, announcing he's on the road to recovery, I think. So that's great news. Degenkolb almost lost a finger and is pretty bashed up. He remains in a hospital in Valencia as we speak, and there's rumours that he could be out for 3 months, which is a long time. Warren Barguil as well will be out for quite a while. He broke his wrist. So a really nasty crash. And I think, yeah, I mean, there were a lot of cyclists, a lot of teams staying in Calpe. You know, it's a very popular winter training base. I saw quite a few teams. Like Astana were out. Anne Post were there, which is why Sean Kelly was there as well, who I chatted to a wee bit. There were a lot of rumours about what exactly had happened, rumours that they'd just been doing a sprint effort and that's when the collision occurred. I spoke to one of the giant Alpecin mechanics who said that wasn't the case, that they were just riding along, you know, minding their own business, and this car came careering towards them on the wrong side of the road. Sean Kelly said that the team had asked them that morning, Anne Post, to borrow a couple of vehicles and some parking cones for exercise. And we wondered whether that had been a factor in what happened, but I don't think so. It was interesting that Giant Alpecin had no team cars there. They had a mechanics truck and a rented van, but no team cars. And as I say, it was a big group of riders, 12, 15 riders, you know, who, when training on the roads, looked quite vulnerable. And they are quite busy roads around there, around the coast especially. Inland, it's much quieter. I was chatting to the young Belgian rider Nathan van Hooijdonk, who rides for BMC's development team, and he was saying that the roads around there are quite busy, and from now onwards they become busier as more and more tourists arrive. And there are a lot of British people there as well, you know, who are in rental cars and so on, and I just wondered about whether it was the safest place. There are certainly quieter parts.
It's interesting, Calpe has become more and more popular every single year, and it seems to be almost de rigueur now as the place to go. It's just, for those who don't know where Calpe is it the Costa?
Costa Brava.
Brava, just above Benidorm, isn't it? Even as recently as 10 years ago, Tuscany was really the place where most teams would go on winter training camps. Not only the Italian teams, the sort of the strip of coastline between Livorno and Grosseto, or just above Rome, there would be a huge sort of enclave of teams there, or huge contingent of teams there every January. But yeah, Calpe is the destination of choice these days. And that's interesting what you say, Rich. If the traffic is bad, it's almost quite surprising that teams are flocking there.
It is. I mean, it depends who you speak to. I mean, speaking to Van Hooydonk, he was saying, I don't know why we all come here because the roads are quite busy. When I spoke to Kelly about that, he said, no, the roads are very quiet. He said it's not as busy as Majorca. Van Hooydonk says, I don't know why we don't go to Majorca. It's much quieter. I was in Majorca the previous week. The roads there are very, very quiet at this time of year. And I think, if you go inland from Calpe, it does become much quieter. But there are certainly quieter places in Spain, I think, if you go further inland, around Sierra Nevada, mountains and places like that. I think Majorca is quieter, but, you know, I mean, this accident could happen at any time, anywhere. It seems to have been the fault of the driver. The riders are, as we're always reminded, sharing public roads with cars. And I drove from Alicante Airport to Calpe, and, you know, the last bit towards the coast, you know, quite mountainous, quite twisting roads. I saw quite a few riders out training. I saw a few Astana riders, and they tend to train without a vehicle with them. And it's a difficult one, because if a team is out with a vehicle, they're also causing quite an obstruction to other road users.
And this is something I've spoken to Rod Ellingworth, the Sky race coach, formerly the director of the British Cycling Academy. I've spoken to him about it before, and he had various experiences back when he was coaching the academy, where particularly in Australia, there was a period in Australia where there were a lot of bad road accidents, and one very notorious one, which unfortunately I think claimed the life of Amy Gillett, who was an Australian Institute of Sport rider. I think it was a fairly big group, or certainly a group of riders, got taken out on that occasion. But Rod, around that time, he spent quite a few periods in Australia with the academy, and he would generally leave them in their groups to go out riding on their own, and he would stay back at the accommodation, the hotel or the flat. And there were a couple of occasions when he got calls from riders who had crashed, and he had to subsequently go to hospital. But he said he lived in terror of receiving a call about precisely that, about the whole group having been taken out. And it is something, unfortunately, that's an occupational hazard.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? I was there in the hotel, and I was, you know, I the press officer from the team came and told me what had happened confidentially, you know, and, you know, obviously I respected that. And at that point, we really didn't know how bad it was. And you know, he told me the riders involved, and that one had been airlifted to hospital. It was Chad Haga, that he lost. And the mechanic told me too that there was a real scare, because he lost a lot of blood. He had deep wounds in his neck in particular. And, you know, I was there, and I ceased to be a journalist, because I didn't, you know, I didn't want to jump the gun. I didn't want to be putting anything out on social media where even the families of the riders hadn't been told, and because we didn't know yet what what actually happened and what the extent of the injuries were. And I was watching on Twitter as news filtered out, and then some of the speculation and some of the rumours, and some of it was pretty far-fetched and wild. And, you know, I think it was important to just not contribute to that, and to just step back and allow the team to release the information as and when that information was actually confirmed.
The same applies with Adriano Malori's crash in the Tour de San Luis, which Lionel mentioned in his roundup. There have been rumours over the last couple of days that he actually had an aneurysm prior to the crash, and that is what actually caused the crash. I mean, the circumstances were fairly unusual. Malori was on the front of the bunch, just seemed to be riding normally, and then all of a sudden came crashing down. It certainly looked slightly curious. But again, as you say, it's purely speculation at this point, and we have to wait to find out what actually happened.
Well, we've really kicked off on quite a somber note, haven't we?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, this is, as Daniel said, it's unfortunate, but it is an occupational hazard. And every time a professional or, you know, elite cyclists want to prepare for their season, you know, they're doing tens of thousands of kilometres a year in training on public roads, and they have to, you know, they have to mix it with the traffic. And as we know, you know, nowhere is immune to the problems of dangerous or bad driving or just, you know, a terrible error of judgment. We don't know the circumstances in Calpe, but, you know, we've all ridden bikes enough to have those near misses and you know, you do sort of touch wood and hope that, you know, every time you get out on the road, it's going to be okay. And these guys, you know, riding in groups, in a way, you know, they are taking up more of the road. And like you say, the possibility of a car hitting, you know, a group is increased in these areas where there are training camps. But the problem is a difficult one to solve. And I remember a few years ago Sky tried to kind of reinvent the wheel a little bit in terms of venues for training camps, didn't they? They had their first training camp in a much more unusual part of Spain, and really anecdotally that, you know, that turned out to be a bit of a disaster.
That was based on 10 years of weather data that showed it was the driest place in Europe, and they arrived and it was it rained constantly.
Unfortunately they booked it in the middle of monsoon season, didn't they?
But again, that was because they thought the area would be quieter as well, I think, at that time of year. And, you know, maybe it wasn't.
I mean, not to be too flippant, but I think we might have mentioned this in the podcast before, but talk about quiet roads. I mean, last year, the same team, Giant Alpecin, or some of their riders, were taken out on a Californian cycle path by Peter Sagan's girlfriend.
Become a friend of the podcast for 2016. For £10, you'll have access to our Friend Specials, 11 in-depth episodes that will take you even further inside the sport. All our Friend Specials are now available on your mobile device. Our 2015 Friend Specials are also still available for £5. To sign up, visit www.thecyclingpodcast.com.
Daniel, well, we've mentioned a couple of things. You were at Giant Alpecin, and you've told us about the strange atmosphere at the Italian embassy in Berlin. Who did you speak to, and, you know, what was the general vibe around the team?
Grabbed some time with Laurens ten Dam, new signing, one of not that many experienced riders in that team. He's come from Lotto Jumbo. At one point, as we'll hear in the interview, it looked and sounded as though ten Dam was contemplating quite a radical change of direction. He was going to go and ride full-time for a US domestic team. It was something that he wanted to do for more as a lifestyle choice, really, than due to any particular goals he had over there. But he's ended up at Giant Alpecin, and he'll be very valuable, I think, for Warren Barguil, who will hopefully recover fairly promptly from the injuries he sustained at the weekend and be competitive later in the year at the Tour de France. But Ten Dam, always a fairly quirky, engaging character. And he told me about his move to Santa Cruz. He's spending a lot of time in Santa Cruz. His love of barbecues, which I think we've documented or we've spoken about before.
Documented his love of barbecues
on the podcast.
It's well documented on the podcast.
Should we just go in and hear?
Yeah, let's hear Laurens ten Dam.
So you're not going to be part-time professional cyclist, part-time nomad, no?
No.
You're still a full-time professional cyclist.
I've got several places to stay next year in the US, and actually from August we don't know yet.
Okay.
After the tour, maybe then it's the nomad thing is getting overhand. You know, then I just do Quebec, Montreal, but I also want to do Leadville 100 mountain bike race. We want to go to Hawaii. We're going to travel. Okay. Yeah, and maybe some holidays, or I don't know, maybe some bike holidays, maybe some people who want to join. I don't know, we'll see.
And I think you did consider for a time joining an American team and maybe racing on the American scene. But where does this fascination with the United States come from? Is it your fascination or your wife's fascination?
Oh, both. I like it. I relax when I'm there. And I always wanted to do 1 year of traveling with the kids before they go to school. First, we were dreaming about like a mobile home holiday in Europe, before we went to the US. And then it became, we went to the US for holidays a few times. And it's just a nice country to me. You know, everything is big, the cars, the food, it's just chill, relax, nice people. Mm. Everyone share their stuff with you. They really
They eat a lot of grilled food, which of course everyone knows you like. Are you still grilling? It's every meal, isn't it? Or at least once every day?
At least once every day. At least at night, I'm grilling. Yeah, so I'm really happy. The Airbnb house we booked needs they had a barbecue on the deck, you know, and it needs to be a grill on the deck. Otherwise, we won't book it. No.
Is there any kind of official recognition of the fact that you have a barbecue every day? Is there any kind of world record?
I like to cook outside, but it's not that I do the dirty stuff, you know. I just grill a small piece of meat or fish. It's not like I do all sausages or things like that. No. I need to stay slim and I need to stay healthy and. But it's just a nice passing time for me. Like in a home in Maastricht, my barbecue was next to the kitchen. You know, I could walk in out and I could chop everything and just throw it on the boat. It was really nice.
And on the road, you'd been in the same team for a long time. You've made a change this year. I mean, we just saw you there at the team presentation, and there are a lot of very very young faces there. And then there's your slightly more let's say more experienced looking face. You will have a big role, won't you, instilling some of your wisdom and some of your experience in a lot of young riders.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to be part of the young team and also to get into the dynamic of young 20 years old, you know, because I'm mid 30 already, and also to save them for some mistakes maybe I made or I saw other people make, or you know, there's a lot of attention coming into those guys, you know. They earn a lot of money at a young age, and to stay focused on cycling, you know. And things what are really important in life. And also maybe not to moan too much too quick about things in the team, not the range and things like that. But see also the good things, like I said, like the amount of clothes at least. We cannot complain, it's not enough, you know, and things that. Apparently we got a really good clothing sponsor, which is also really good quality. And I was smiling because I also do less races, but I can put every race new socks on already now. I got a bunch of socks. I've never seen so much, you know. And what I see from this team, it's a good team.
And having had your top 10, it was top 10 in the Tour de France 2 years ago. Is it a relief slightly to be out of a Dutch team and to be away from some of the pressure, maybe pressure you put on yourself as well to repeat that?
I got a lot of pressure for myself last year. It caught up with me a little bit, to be honest. That's what I mean, to get away maybe those pressure from Tom or Warren. We also take a lot of pressure.
I mean, I remember seeing you after the team time trial last year, and you were a broken man, weren't you?
Yeah, that was really, you know, and things got worse from there, and I broke the back a week after the tour, and that's why I decided, okay, stop it, you know, and I decided, what are you doing? And from Paris, if you count 100 days backwards, I was only 10 days home, and I got two small kids, you know, and that's why I decided, I want to do a little bit balanced, private, and cycling. And
so you considered stopping everything there, did you?
No, I considered going to the US and racing for domestic Jelly Belly team like that or something like that, and just for fun. And I don't mind being in my naked ass next to a car changing clothes after a crit or something. I was looking forward to that, you know, and get rid of all the pressure I put on myself. And I'm really happy in the team now, and I think I'm going to have a good year together with Warren, Tom and the other guys.
You know? 1 year contract, you're going to be helping Tom, you're going to specifically, I think, be helping Warren at the tour. Are you looking beyond that 1 year? Are you thinking you'll stick around for even longer?
I'm not looking beyond actually August anymore. I don't have a house yet back then, no, but we'll see, you know. The thing is, April 2017, my oldest is 5. He needs to go to school in Holland, so maybe for sure we'll be back in Holland. I don't know what I do next winter then. Maybe I train for a new season. Maybe I do bicycle holidays in the US, traveling on my mountain bike or, I don't know, gravel bike, and have fun with friends and invite them to come over and camping and things like that. We'll see, you know. If I really like it, I can still do another year from Europe then, from March 2017. If the team likes it, it also depends, you know. Some things just come to an end too, and sometimes you have to call it a day and move on to new things. I don't know. So far, I'm focused on the tour and what happens after. For sure, it will be good things. No worries. I'm not worried about the black hole, we say, after the career, you know. Got plenty of things to do. I got nice kids. I got plenty of holidays in my head I need to do.
And thousands of barbecues.
Yeah, thousands of grilling and good meat and big Sunday roasts, and have fun, drink wine, and enjoy life. And maybe I can share that with other people. That's also something I'd like to do, and maybe we can have big barbecues at night after big rides during the day and have fun. And we'll see.
So we heard there from Lawrence Tendam, the new recruit at Giant Alpecin, 35 years old now, I think he is. He's a veteran, as you say, but a good climber and somebody who will be of great assistance in the stage races. We saw last year at the Vuelta where Tom Dumoulin was in a race-winning position, how little support he had in the mountains. In fact, John Degenkolb was one of his key support riders there. So Tendam really increases their strength in the stage races. But you know, you were at the launch before the crash that we spoke about in part one. What kind of effect is that going to have on the team? They're obviously going to be missing a few key riders for potentially some time, which is a loss in itself, but it will also put more strain on all the other riders, won't it?
Yeah, it will, and I have slight concerns about that team and the experience in that team. I mean, they do have guys who have a lot of seasons under their belt, the likes of Tom Wheeler's, Roy Curvers, guys who have been around a lot, but they are not the guys who they will be relying on for victories. And you know, at this time of year, I always look at teams and think, where are the early wins going to come from? Because I think that's really important for a team, and not to get into a rut. We've seen it. There's always one team. Every season, there's one team which gets to April, May, without a victory, and they start panicking, and it really becomes a big problem. And probably the riders make poor decisions in races because there's this desperation to get on the score sheet, so to speak. And Giant now, without Degenkolb, who is one of their bankers, they're going to be without him for the first couple of months, 2-3 months.
Potentially, yeah.
And, you know, without Balguin for a while as well. I just worry slightly that they might find themselves...
And without Marcel Kittel. Without him last year as well.
Another rider who was involved in the crash, unfortunately, is the German sprinter for Neopro this year, Max Walscheid, who was going to... Well, certainly everyone I spoke to at the Giant Alpecin team launch in Berlin had been very, very impressed with him in the training camps that they'd had. Up to that point, he'd been sprinting against Degenkolb in practice sprints, beating him fairly comprehensively, and there was a lot of excitement about what he might do early this year. Talk of him being the new Kittel, probably slightly exaggerated, but still. And he was someone who could potentially have picked up some early wins for them. He's going to be out for a while as well, so I think it's going to be a delicate period. Having said that, the crash might also bring them together. It might
galvanise them.
Yeah, it might galvanise them. So certainly we would keep our fingers crossed that will happen.
But you spoke to Tom Wheelers as well, who was Kittel's lead-out man, and you know, you spoke to him about the very strange position he finds himself in, now being possibly, arguably, or someone who's been described as the world's best lead-out man without the world's best sprinter.
Yeah, he's the sort of bride's left standing at the altar, isn't he, really? Now that the glistening blonde Adonis has been whipped away from him.
Kittel, we should point out, has joined Etics Quickstep.
He has joined Etics Quickstep.
Any gossip on, you know, what... We still don't really know what happened with Kittel.
Well, there have been a few things over the past few weeks that have leaked out. Certainly the suggestion that Giant Alpecin run a very, very tight ship, and even Spreckenbrink, the manager, is someone who likes his protocols. He likes everything to be very well organised, very prescribed, certainly in terms of itineraries when riders are at races, when they're not at races. They have to report back to the team a lot. And Kittel, being the star man, was under a lot of pressure, I think, in terms of PR obligations, etc. So I think he was being asked to do a lot of different things. And I think at a certain point, that maybe became a little bit asphyxiating for him. The team also, I mean, I wouldn't link this to Kittel's departure, but the team, for example, has a very, very strict internal anti-doping policy protocols. This was something I spoke to Spreckenbrink about. He even suggested that the team might go so far, he didn't say whether they had done this, but they might go so far as to search riders' bags if they had any suspicions that they might be taking illegal medicine to races. So, that is very much the sort of context, the environment at Giant Alpecin. And I think at a certain point, Kittel decided that it all got a little bit too much for him. And he's moved to an environment which is very, very different. Etics Quickstep is probably I would say, the opposite end of the scale in terms of being quite relaxed and quite sort of ad hoc in some respects. It'll be interesting to see whether that sort of breath of fresh air, I'm sure Kittel will see it that way, will have a positive effect on him. And the same applies to Dan Martin, I think. I mean, Dan Martin has moved from a team, was different from Giant Alpecin, but he's moved from Cannondale Garmin, which again has its own quirks and its own quite particular ways of doing things, and he's moved to Etix, where I think it will be a lot more laissez-faire, the approach, and it'll be interesting to see whether that galvanises him.
Let's hear from Tom Wheelers, shall we? This is Daniel in conversation with Tom Wheelers.
Tom, I remember 2 years ago, I think it was Algemeen Dagblad said that you were the best lead out man in the world, but now you're a lead out man without a sprinter to lead out, it seems like, because your partner in crime Marcel Kittel has left. Does that leave you in a difficult position?
They read that I am the best lead out man in the world, but of course there are other really good lead out guys, and I think this is the best lead out team in the world, so it was the team who did it, and not me as a person on my own. Next to that, we have some really strong guys. Maybe they didn't achieve what Marcel achieved last year, but we have Max Walscheid, who's an upcoming German sprinter, where I'm really curious how far he can come in sprints, because he's pushing a lot of values and doing good sprints in training, but only needs fine-tuning in races. Mm. Furthermore, we have Ramon Sinkeldam, Dutch rider, who's also good in sprinting, and Nikias Arndt, who's also good in that. I have to say, exceptional talent of Marcel was huge. He was one of the top sprinters. In some moment, he was the top sprinter in the world, because he was extremely fast, extremely powerful, and leading him out was, of course, led to a success of also our team, because it made it visible that we are doing good lead outs. And when a good sprinter fails and becomes second or third, then you at least tried to get him on the highest platform, but the outer public doesn't see that we are doing a good job.
How much did him not racing last year affect you? Were you kind of sometimes sitting at home waiting, wondering when Marcel was going to be fit again, and waiting to define your race program in accordance with what he was going
to
do?
So it was completely messed up due to sickness and due to and it was from him, from his part, but also from my part. I never experienced a year like that, because I had a knee injury, what I still have some problems with last year, what really sidelined me for almost all the season, also made me not ride for a really, really long time.
It's not as though you were kind of waiting around to see, waiting for myself to get fit. You were struggling yourself.
I could ride a schedule, and I could settle myself in helping others. Yeah. And it was not only Marcel who was the guy for us. There were more guys for us who are good to work for and also can do a big result.
There was never a chance of you going with Marcel to Etix, no?
I still have a contract, and that was not in the plan, no.
Yeah. And would you say that Marcel is an easy guy to lead out? He's gone to Etix, there's a team there which is not set up for him. You'd built your team, you'd built your lead out over 3 or 4 years, and you'd done an awful lot of practice at altitude and training camps at altitude and et cetera, et cetera. And he's gone there, and he's going to have to do that again. Do you think it'll be a problem for him?
On some hand, yes, and some hand, no, because he has a new team, so the riders have to get used to his tactics and things how he wants to be lead out. But you know, Marcel was new in our team, so that's why it took some time to lead him out, of course, because we had to get used to each other, and he was new in sprinting, so he really has to get a tactic, and also to know when to go, what is really important, of course. Mm-hmm. And over the years he developed that, and we developed ourselves as well, and in the end it made him win and us as well a lot of nice races, also in Grand Tours and day races. And I think he has to get used to it this year with his new teammates. But Marcel is really powerful, and also he can tell for sure his new team colleagues how he wants it. Maybe it's going a little bit often wrong compared to what he's used to with us last year. For sure, he'll manage to do good result.
How do you see the balance of power now between the top sprinters? Everyone expected Marcel to continue his domination last year. What actually happened was that Andre Greipel sort of had a resurgence, and then Cavendish is still there and Kittel is coming back. I mean, how do you think those three are going to measure up this year?
You have a lot of guys who are also competing with these riders and also beating them, John Buhani, De Maer, of course Christophe. These riders are also really, really strong. But due to maximum speed and maximum power, I think these are the main guys last season. And I think when they're all fit, you can see a lot of nice challenges. Mm. And I hope with one of our sprinters we can work things out and see if there's something possible to jump in there and get a victory somewhere. Mm.
You talk to any of the sprinters now, and particularly Cavendish, and he talks about how sprints have changed over the course of his career, and they've changed partly because of what your team did and how your team changed the lead out. It was more aggressive, it was later, etc. I mean, what changes have you seen over the years?
I saw, of course, some changes. Yeah, before, I think it was everybody just respected HCC and were riding behind them. But we knew as well that when we start behind this lead out, because they had a really strong lead out, that we would go on would be too far back for beating them.
Yeah.
So we had to fix a plan, and it's not aggressive, but it's just a way that we were coming late with full power on a shorter bit instead of riding 5K already on the front and doing it like HCC did it. So it was just an adaptation to our thing, how we could beat, because you have to find tricks, fair tricks, to beat each other.
Typically, to be specific, the kind of flag would come down for you guys at sort of 2.5k to go around there, 2k.
No, it depends on the finish.
Yeah.
If it's flat straight, it can be 1 kilometer.
Yeah.
But if it's a lot of curves and I don't know what, wind or something, it could be 5.
Yeah.
So it's depends all on the course.
Last thing, did you get a Christmas card from Mark Cavendish? Because he still talks a lot about the 2012 crash in San Marlo.
No.
And you didn't send one either.
What do you think?
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool. Pair your power meter with over 800 workouts and 80 training plans to make you a faster cyclist. Visit trainerroad.com/TCP to try Trainer Road risk-free for 30 days.
And we mentioned earlier on that our training really continues, Lionel, not Daniel, but Rob Hatch is also still very committed, I think, to the Trainer Road programme. And we're all building up towards our race, which looks like it might happen at the Manchester Velodrome.
I'm stunned by this news that with Herne Hill and now Manchester Velodrome,
anyone at Herne Hill.
They didn't
reply to my emails.
How do we go from talking about Tom Wheeler's muscle, because the very pinnacle of professional cycling, to
it's a pretty easy segue, Daniel.
Pub Sunday League.
This
pair of cloggers.
Sometime in March, there'll be the big showdown. Myself, Lionel Burney, and Rob Hatch at the Manchester Velodrome. We're trying to get some coaches roped in for the occasion.
Have you sold the TV rights yet, Rich?
Working on that. Buying the sale of the TV rights. If anyone, we offer some money to someone to come and film it, please. No, it'll be good fun. And I'm still enjoying the programme very much. It's all very good. We're going to do a little Kilometre Zero special on our training, on training generally, I think, but looking at the training we've been doing, and hopefully that'll be of interest to anyone who is also, like us, an elite athlete, almost professional cyclist. Anyway, there has been some proper racing going on the last week or so in Argentina and Australia. Tour Down Under, first world tour race
always
of the year.
Always Lionel's favourite race.
Always Lionel's favourite
race.
I've
got a bit of criticism for my comment in one of the friends specials at the end of the year for calling it a pre-season friendly, the Tour Down Under. But by that.
You've reminded me there. I was supposed to mention the friends specials. Thank you to everybody who has signed up to become a friend of the podcast in 2016. There's been a really great response to our 2016 package. We released our first friends special last week, which was behind the scenes with Chris Froome in the lab when he went in to do his tests. And the next one is our special on HTC High Road, which is coming up in February, and that includes a very interesting interview with Bob Stapleton, conducted by Daniel. And that'd be really interesting, I hope. And there's been a great response. Thank you very much. It's £10 for the year. That will get you 11 exclusive Friends podcasts. And they are available on your mobile phone. You'll get a feed for 2016. You can also now get a feed for 2015. So they're fully downloadable on your mobile phone. Thecyclingpodcast.com to sign up to become a friend of the podcast. So the racing, Lionel, Tour Down Under. Mm. Sorry, I stopped you mid-flow there. You were just waxing lyrical about the Tour Down Under.
Well, I mean, it's getting slightly harder, slightly more challenging, isn't it? Look, there's definitely a sense that it's a tougher race than it used to be when, you know, it used to just be basically four or five sprint stages and Willunga Hill. Now there's a couple of lumpier stages, which is plays into Simon Gerrans' hands, really. He's now he's the Eddie Merckx of the Tour Down Under, with four wins in the Tour Down Under's long and illustrious history, which stretches all the way back to the year 2000.
Okay, Lionel, that's enough. That's enough. We value our audience in Australia. I've been the Tour Down Under a couple of times, unlike you, and I can tell you that it's a fantastic race.
Absolutely.
And there's lots to commend it, and the riders, I think, love it.
And there's a big scrap for World Tour points already.
Mm. Yeah, I mean,
press releases this week from teams celebrating their first World Tour points.
This does matter. You mentioned the importance of teams getting off to a winning start. Orica Green Edge with Caleb Ewan and Simon Gerrans have got off to a great start.
Classic example, Richard.
Cannondale Garmin, I was going to mention.
You mentioned their HTC High Road or High Road special.
Mm.
You know, as we will talk about, as we will discuss, I think in that, Andre Greipel winning how many stages?
Four stages
of that in 2008 was seen as a real springboard for that team, not only in that season but throughout their history.
Yeah, good point. Even though, you know, when you were talking earlier, Daniel, about teams struggling to get the momentum and then, you know, that becoming a bit of a monkey on the back of a team not getting that first win. Cannondale, Garmin were the obvious example last year, and I noticed Jonathan Vauter is tweeting furiously about the successes that his team had. I think they had a decent Tour Down Under. They won the team classification, and he was certainly enjoying that, Jonathan Vauter, but clearly keen to not to get this season off to a slightly different start to last season.
Well, absolutely. I mean, for Simon Gerrans, I mean, last year it really was a terrible year for him. He crashed just before the Tour Down Under. Broke his collarbone there. He crashed again at the Strada Bianchi in Italy in, when's that?
March,
isn't it? Fractured his elbow. Came back, crashed again at Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Crashed and abandoned the Giro halfway through. Crashed on stage three of the Tour in that terrible crash. Mm. And broke his wrist. And, I mean, you know, that's pretty much as bad as luck can get. And so, for him, hugely important to get back, get 2016 off to a good start, off to a winning start. And for Orica Green Edge, you know, it's their home race, hugely important for them. And Caleb Ewan,
interesting, isn't
stepped
it?
Up a level and now is sort of moving into the bracket of Kittel, Cavendish and co. In the sprint stakes.
I mean, Orica, they're an interesting, you know, they've lost some of the sort of talismen, the Australian talismen that when the team was set up, you thought the team was going to form around the likes of Cameron Meyer, who's now at Dimension Data, people like that.
Matt Goss,
yeah. But
you know, opening the batting for one pro cycling
next week at the Tour de Dubai, yeah. Well, very good. But they're you know, Gerrans is still obviously a force to be reckoned with. Caleb Ewan is the young, you know, and very promising looking sprinter who does get incredibly low over the front of his bike, dangerously low, I think. I mean, at what point is he going to just tip over? And do a sort of somersault. It's going to happen, isn't it? It's going to be Amdou Japarov like, but without the coke barrier. Anyway, Caleb Ewan, how good is he?
Cadel McEwan, as one illustrious sprinter referred to him at this time last year when I put it to him that Caleb Ewan might be the next big thing in sprinting.
Oh, yeah, who is that?
well, I won't say. How good is he going to be? I think the question is whether he's going to become a pure sprinter or whether he's someone with a lot more to his riding than that, and someone who can potentially win classics, potentially win, well, certainly is a potential Milan-San Remo winner in the future. And will he lose speed?
But not riding Milan-San Remo this year.
Not riding, okay. Mm. But he's someone who is got great leg speed, very, very fast, nippy, reminiscent of Cavendish. Those qualities tend to ebb slightly with age. Is he someone who will become, as I say, more of an all-round rider as the years go by? I certainly think that he could be prolific in the next 2 or 3 years.
You get the sense that Orica are really handling him very carefully in the same way that they have with the Yates brothers, really. They're really looking at their long-term development, and Ewan seems to have been around for a few years already, but he's very sort of gradually being exposed to harder and harder racing, I think. And, you know, Orica are proving themselves to be quite a good team in terms of managing talent in that sense.
Still only 21, so you could argue he's off to a sort of faster start to his career than Cavendish was, who, you know, who once he got winning, he was unstoppable for a few years. So, you know, Ewan, I think, is going to do the Giro, isn't he? So it'll be, you know, that will be the first big opportunity to see how good he is at this early stage in his career. But, you know, it's good to see somebody come along who does, you know, create a bit of a talking point. The way he sprints is exciting to watch. It's different. It is reminiscent of Cavendish when he was doing that very low
sprint, but more extreme.
But it is more extreme, and it clearly works for him.
Yeah, we thought that when Cavendish did emerge in 2008 with this very distinctive style, that there would be a whole glut of riders that came after him mimicking his style. A few did come and go and briefly threaten to do just that. You know, Andrea Guardini was one, a very diminutive guy, got very low over the bars. But actually, it was the sort of big, powerful sprinters that kind of returned and have held sway over the last couple of years, isn't it, with people like Kittel and Greipel. And I mentioned Valscheid earlier, the young giant Alpecin sprinter, who's another one who's, you know, I think he's 6'6", 6'7". So it'll be interesting contrasting styles if Ewan does develop in the way that we expect up against those bigger guys.
Right, listen, we should wrap up there.
Well, just very quickly, what about Richie Porte?
What about Richie Porte?
One on Willunga Hill.
He's won on Willunga Hill before.
Yeah, but in this time in a red and black jersey as opposed to in a blue and black jersey. I mean, so hugely what? Significant.
Not really, Lionel.
If Willunga Hill is the Alpe d'Huez of Adelaide, what is Corkscrew Road? Is that the Nossa Senhora da Graça?
That's exactly what it is. You took the words right out of my mouth.
The emblematic climb of the Volta a Portugal. No?
Oh, right, yeah.
You haven't thought that.
That's certainly what the hipsters call it. There was big news last week with the Giro d'Italia wildcards. No place for Gianni Savio and Androni Giocattoli.
End of an era.
It is. Well, it could well be the end of the team. The team's been around for 20 years, and well, they're going to celebrate the 20th year at the end of this year. I spoke to Gianni briefly last week. He's pretty pessimistic. And, you know, that the gap between the haves and have-nots of professional cycling has just grown wider and wider over the last 3 or 4 years. And, you know, Savio is really trying to compete with the same budget that he had a few years ago. And the same budget he had 4 or 5 years ago, maybe 4 or 5 million euros. Meanwhile, the leading teams in the World Tour have gone from 20 to 30 to 40 million.
I mean, this has happened quite dramatically and almost without really being discussed all that much. It's really over the last 4 or 5 years. I think Jonathan Vaughters spoke about it last year at the Tour. This huge, huge, you know, a few years ago, T-Mobile were, you know, the best funded team in the world at 10 million euros a year, 12 million euros a year budget. Now you're talking 30 million.
Yeah, they have. And the quality of the rider that teams like Androni Giocattoli can sign has diminished in line with that trend, really. And they found themselves having to fish around for guys who
were... Savio was even talking about coming to the Manchester Velodrome in March just to keep tabs on our three-man race.
they've found themselves having to... they're still trying very hard to exploit the Italian talent pool, but the Italian talent pool is no longer what it was. You know, the big Italian under 23 races no longer represent the benchmark in amateur cycling. So, you know, they still perhaps pick up some of the best graduating under 23s, but they're no longer necessarily the biggest talents on the international stage. And they've also found themselves having to pick up guys who are really in the last chance saloon, and often it's a very risky exercise, and they've had numerous positive tests in the last 3 or 4 years, perhaps not been vigilant enough. But it's also it comes with the territory of trying to pick up bargains, you know.
Well, and also, I mean, the market's changed in the sense that Saverio used to go and pick up riders from South America for next to nothing. Now those South American riders are back in vogue with the bigger teams and are getting opportunities with World Tour teams at much earlier stages. So the landscape has changed.
Yeah, and you know, there are questions to be asked over whether the Giro should be protecting teams that probably, Italian teams that perhaps don't deserve to be there on merit anymore, such as Savia's team, such as Bardiani, such as Southeast. My personal view is that they perhaps could have given Androni Giocattoli a chance, certainly over Gazprom, the Rosvello, the Cattugia development team. Effectively, there are various issues there. That team has had positive tests. There is a potential conflict of interest or potential common interest with Cattugia, so you could potentially have a World Tour team there and its development team effectively, you know, riding for the same objectives, and which creates problems. I think the reality is, and no one has really said this explicitly, but I think there are financial reasons for having Gazprom there.
Well, yeah, you only have to look at sports sponsorship in a wider context than cycling, and the name Gazprom is prominent in Champions League football, tennis, other sports. So RCS obviously having a challenging time commercially at the moment. You know, decisions have to be made, and you know, Savio has found himself on the wrong side of the line this time.
And it would be naive, I think, to suggest this is the first time that's happened as well. I mean, last year we saw the Polish team, CCC, taking part in the Giro again, and there was talk, there were rumours there of, I wouldn't say money having changed hands, but certainly a bit of mutual back scratching. Even going further back, I think there have been teams that have not necessarily been chosen on merit.
Right, well, on that note, the racing continues next week. Tour of Dubai, isn't it? Second Tour of Dubai. Marcel Kittel making his debut for Etics. Quick set, be interested to see how he gets on there. He will want to, I think, start winning early.
Flying, I've heard, in training.
Really?
Absolutely flying.
We heard that before the Tour de France last year, and he didn't end up going.
I've heard that...
Actually, I heard that he beat Tony Martin in a test that they carried out. Brian Holmes said that. So he's flying in tests, but will that translate to the road? Because clearly there might be a confidence issue there as well. You just don't know. Anyway, we don't like speculation, do we, Lionel? We'll just see what happens.
I would speculate that his hair will be looking magnificent.
His hair is amazing. I mean, I saw it a couple of weeks ago. I saw his hair.
Really?
Right.
He wasn't wearing a baseball cap.
Did an interview with him for a forthcoming special, Friends of the Podcast special. That's another one coming up. Did an interview with him, and he was munching an apple, which wasn't great for a podcast interview, but we managed to get around that, and his hair was looking incredibly...
Even without the giant Alpecin.
Even without that. Well, he might still use Alpecin. I don't know. Who knows? Anyway.
Does he not now have to use Lidl's own brand shampoo?
Well, if he does, he's a great advert for it. I think we'll all be getting some Lidl own brand shampoo. Won't we?
I won't. It's a bit late for me.
Anyway, listen, let's leave it there. We'll be back next week, and we'll have more interviews and analysis from the training camps and the racing and so on. So thank you very much for listening this week. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.